bear in mind the section from the Sheehan affidavit that we read earlier. With this team, Secord, was in Iran the entire time in an official U.S. government capacity, while Shakli, Kleins et al. Were continuing, apparently in what one might refer to as national security establishment inertia, in defiance of presidential orders. But they were in that area in an official capacity at the time.
Now, again, none of this stuff, of course, has been talked about. It was talked about in the Iran-Contra hearings. Secord's involvement, as I mentioned earlier, we've been talking about Secord for years. He's been involved in more things than a normal human being could possibly comprehend in terms of illegal and illicit activities on behalf of this shadowy right-wing agenda. This brings something to mind. I was just driving back from Southern California, and Daniel Sheehan was on KABC, or I'm not sure what the station is, but the main ABC affiliate radio station down in Los Angeles, and he was being interviewed by Michael Jackson. And one of the things that Sheehan said is that they've been in talking to the staffers for the congressman on the Iran-Contra hearings. And he was specifically talking about drugs, but I think things like Secord being involved in the failed Desert One mission, it probably falls in the same category. And he said they would begin telling these congressional staffers about the drugs connections and things of that nature. Not only did most of them, their eyes just sort of glaze over and they sort of change the subject, but he said one of them actually literally lifted his pencil up in the air, held it over his head, and said, "I'm not writing anything, I'm not writing anything, I don't hear a thing, I'm not writing anything down," and threw them out of the office a couple of minutes later. So, again, the reason that this stuff is out there is not that this is far-fetched stuff, folks. It's right here in black and white, but there are people who will not listen to this until it is too late, and we hope that's not going to be soon.
Yeah, as serious as the events that we're looking at appear to be, and as I say, there are a lot of indications that the Carter presidency was deliberately deep-sixed by these people, obviously in direct contravention of U.S. law and political traditions. There are indications that this same team was going to continue to manipulate terrorism in a strategic fashion to overthrow the Constitution itself, not merely to spit at it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to talk about another interesting connection. We're going to talk about Cyrus Hashemi, the late Cyrus Hashemi, and we're going to talk about some people that he was in business with, namely Jay Stanton, Stanley Pottinger, among others, and some of their interesting involvement in some of the things that we've studied. But that's going to be after we take a break. So we'll be coming back with an article and then a long tape segment on the friends of Cyrus Hashemi. We are here to continue with Radio Free America. Tonight's topic, of course, the Iran-Contra hearings, not the Iran-Contra hearings. It's just been jammed into my head so much, being the media baby that I am. The Iran-Contra affair, whatever you want to call it. We've been talking specifically about a couple of things tonight. We've been talking about the secret team and, in part, their formation and their early involvement in things. We talked a lot about them last week, about their springing up out of the JM Wave Station, their then transfer of authority to Southeast Asia, their dabbling in the drug traffic and various other activities there, and their continuation, and in fact the transfer of some key members to Tehran, Iran, where later on they were to become, we think, the authors of much of our present plight in the Middle East, and perhaps with the authors of the sabotaging of the hostage rescue attempt, the Desert One mission, so-called, and that's what we've been talking about in the last part of the broadcast tonight.
In particular, we've looked at the strategic manipulation of the terrorist incident, one of the most famous terrorist incidents, at least in terms of American consciousness, namely the taking of the U.S. hostages at the embassy in Tehran in 1979. We took a look at some steps Jimmy Carter took to anger members of the secret team, his cutting off of CIA subsidies to the mullahs in Iran, plus his firing by his CIA director, Admiral Stansfield Turner, of a number of members of the secret team, including Messrs. Shakli, Kleins, and Edwin Wilson. Henry Kissinger connected to those same people through Task Force 157, then pressured Carter to admit the Shah. That resulted in the hostage crisis, and as we just looked at considerable length, it appears that the members of the secret team then deep-sixed the attempt to rescue the hostages in April of 1980, thereby adding to Jimmy Carter's popular image as a wimp. And I think go around asking people today what Carter was like, they'll say he was terrible, they'll say he was a wimp, you know, that he just wouldn't stand up to them Iranians. It's an image which endures to this day. And again, not to whip a dead horse, but we're not charging that the actual people used at the operational levels in these terrorist incidents are necessarily working for our government, but this secret team has been manipulating terrorism, manipulating the outcomes of these acts in such a way as to deliberately affect U.S. foreign policy, and at least in this case, apparently, to get rid of an American president. We're going to take a look now at a name that's cropped up in a big way in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal. This person was also involved in negotiations, allegedly, to get the hostages released. As we're going to look at, this person who appears to have been assassinated using a very sophisticated method of assassination when he later became involved in the later Iranian arms deals, it appears from this person's contacts with people connected to the secret team that he may have been one of the people involved in the October surprise group, that is, seeing to it that the hostages did not get released. This man's name is Cyrus Hashemi, and there's a very good article about him that appeared in the San Jose Mercury News of Saturday, June 13th of 1987. This is an LA Times story, Dateline New York, and headline, Mysterious Death of Iranian Arms Dealer Under Investigation. Congressional committees probing the Iran-Contra scandal are investigating the mysterious death in London last summer of Iranian weapons dealer Cyrus Hashemi, who had sought unsuccessfully to become a key middleman in the arms for hostages trade. Sources also say a U.S. government informant who had worked with Hashemi alleges that Customs Service officials told him that the arms dealer may have been bumped off, unquote, by government agents to protect the then-secret Iran initiative. Documents filed in federal court in Washington this week support the accounts by these sources who spoke on condition of anonymity. According to sources in Washington and London, a Senate investigator had made two trips to England to meet with government and medical authorities familiar with the Hashemi case. Hashemi, a rival for roles ultimately assumed by Adnan Khashoggi and Manoucher Gurbanifar in the Iran operation, died suddenly on July 21st, 3 months before the secret arms deals were disclosed. Officially, death was attributed to a rare and virulent form of leukemia that was diagnosed only 2 days before Hashemi died. Since then, persistent questions have been raised about the accuracy of those autopsy results and whether chemical or radiation injections or sprays could have caused similar symptoms. Quote, There are lots of sophisticated methods of assassination these days, a committee source said. Given all the circumstances, we'd be ignoring our responsibility if we didn't follow up what is, at the very least, a mysterious death of an important link, unquote, in the Iran arms affair. At the time of his death, the 47-year-old Hashemi was acting as a confidential customs informant in a $2.5 billion sting operation that led to the arrests of a retired Israeli general and two Khashoggi business associates. Their case is pending. A customs official, while expressing skepticism about suggestions of exotic foul play in the death, conceded this week, a mystery writer couldn't have done it better, unquote. Hashemi first emerged as a controversial character in early attempts at clandestine relations between the United States and the Revolutionary Government of Iran. In 1980, after 52 hostages were seized at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, Hashemi, who was based in London, offered to help negotiate for their release. He claimed to be a cousin of Hashemi Rafsanjani, now leader of the Iranian parliament, recalled Lloyd Cutler, legal counsel to President Carter at the time. We met with him in New York, but nothing important came of it. Hashemi did, however, open contacts with officials in Tehran and went on to use those contacts to sell U.S. arms to Iran in 1981 and 1982. He and two of his brothers were indicted in 1984 for their roles in those transactions. One went to jail, but Hashemi and the other brother fled back to England, claiming the sales were part of their effort to open channels necessary to help get hostages released. Well, again, we don't know exactly in what capacity Cyrus Hashemi was working in connection with the hostages. There are indications, though, because of his association with a fellow named J. Stanley Pottinger, who we spoke about in our last Radio Free America program on this subject, that in fact he may have been part of the secret team. We're going to now play you a section from one of our archive shows, and this particular archive show is a One Step Beyond show called The CIA, The Women's Movement, and the News Media. How this particular article emerged in the context of that discussion is that the man, J. Stanley Pottinger, who we talked about in our last broadcast on the subject, we're going to talk about him some more tonight, was a partner of Cyrus Hashemi in some of his weapons transactions with Tehran. We're going to roll a tape right now, and by the way, you'll hear a little bit of interference. This is a section from a One Step Beyond show, which was on this archive tape, permanently available now on Audio Archives, and the tape was improperly bulked, and so you'll hear a little bit of a, an undercurrent there. That's Nip Tuck's voice from a phone-in section of an old One Step Beyond show that I used to get to tape the prepared portion for this One Step Beyond show. The actual article itself is buried deep in our file, so we're utilizing the tape. So, but this is by way of alerting listeners. If you hear a little bit of undercurrent, that is not something. It's not interference. It's actually on the tape. We apologize, but alas, our files are too cavernous and at this point too stirred up to yield this particular article. So we are going to give it to you on Oxide. I'm going to play a short section of One Step Beyond show from June 17th, 1984. You're going to hear some material here from Newsweek magazine, as well as some material from the New York Times. And what it's going to be talking about is Gloria Steinem's paramour for about the past, well, it was 9 years since 84. I don't know whether they're still together, but that's a long time to be with anybody, you know, in terms of a dating relationship. Gloria Steinem's relationship with a man named J. Stanley Pottinger. Who J. Stanley Pottinger is, some of the things he has been involved in, is going to be the next thing we're going to take up in relation to Gloria Steinem and the whole Ms. Axis. Playing now from the from One Step Beyond, June 17th, 1984. Another interesting article, interesting bit of information here concerning Gloria Steinem, and again, this on the occasion of her 50th birthday. This is from Newsweek, the issue of June 4th, 1984. There's an article on Gloria Steinem's 50th birthday. It's very short. It's entitled, Steinem at 50, Gloria in Excelsis. And I'm only going to read you one sentence of this article. In previous incarnations, Steinem dated Mike Nichols, Rafer Johnson, and other notables. For the past 9 years, she has been romantically involved with Washington attorney Stanley Pottinger, a Republican and former assistant attorney general for civil rights. Reading that sentence again. In previous incarnations, Steinem dated Mike Nichols, Rafer Johnson, and other notables. For the past 9 years, she has been romantically involved with Washington attorney Stanley Pottinger, last name P-O-T-T-I-N-G-E-R, a Republican and former assistant attorney general for civil rights. Well, he was an assistant attorney general for civil rights under the Nixon Ford administration from 1973 to 1977. You'll all recall what Nixon's Justice Department was like. Both Mr. Kleindienst and John Mitchell were indicted. Mitchell convicted, and Kleindienst eventually, I don't know whether he was convicted and received a suspended sentence or whether he eventually was acquitted, but half the Nixon Justice Department wound up being indicted on one charge or another. Many of them acquitted, most in connection with the Watergate affair. They also presided over COINTELPRO and a number of other interesting things. Certainly the Nixon administration has never been regarded as a great champion of civil rights, and a woman like Gloria Steinem, who is at least nominally aligned with a civil rights movement, the feminist movement, well, her association, her 9-year romantic involvement with Mr. Pottinger is really intriguing. Now, those of you who listen to Mae Russell's World Watchers series will recall Mae referring very briefly to Mr. Pottinger's involvement in an arms smuggling scam. Research credit for the following article, again, goes to Mr. Ted Rubenstein. By the way, that Newsweek article, if you'd like to look it up, is from June 4th, 1984. Now, concerning Mr. Pottinger and his alleged involvement in an arms smuggling scam, the following article, research credit, goes to Ted Rubenstein. This is from the New York Times of June 3rd, 1984. It's an article by Selwyn Rabb, R-A-B-B, headlined, Iranian is sought in inquiry on arms. Subtitled, Banker Wanted in Smuggling of Prohibited Equipment. An Iranian banker in New York City who offered to help seek the release of the American hostages in Iran in 1980 is under investigation for leading a group that purportedly smuggled banned military equipment to Iran, according to federal authorities. The investigation, which began 4 years ago, resulted in the arrests in New York last month of the brother of the banker and of a Huntington, Long Island businessman on smuggling charges. According to federal officials, a former United States Assistant Attorney General, W. Stanley Pottinger, is also under investigation. The 44-year-old Mr. Pottinger, who was in charge of the Civil Rights Division in the Justice Department from 1973 to 1977, recently testified before the federal grand jury in Manhattan investigating the case. He did not return telephone calls left at his Manhattan office
or his home. So again, he is being investigated in connection with, that is to say, W. Stanley Pottinger, longtime paramour of Gloria Steinem, 9 years to be exact, is being investigated in connection with an arms smuggling case, which in turn is connected with a possible attempt to seek the release of the American hostages in Iran in 1980. Reading the last paragraph again. According to federal officials, a former United States Assistant Attorney General, W. Stanley Pottinger, is also under investigation. The 44-year-old Mr. Pottinger, who was in charge of the Civil Rights Division in the Justice Department from 1973 to 1977, recently testified before the federal grand jury in Manhattan investigating the case. He did not return telephone calls left at his Manhattan office or his home. This certainly isn't conclusive, obviously, because, first of all, Pottinger's only being investigated in connection with the case, but that his name should turn up at all, and I understand from broadcast news reports on the subject, there haven't been many in print, that apparently his voice was on wiretaps of this the Hashemis, the Iranians involved in this arms smuggling scam and also in the attempt to obtain the release of the hostages from Iran. Well, of course, arms smuggling is a major focus of intelligence activity, and Iran, of course, has also been a major focus of intelligence activity for many, many years. And among the many people who crop up in connection with attempts to obtain the release of the American hostages, Frank Turple and his connections, Frank Turple and former Congressman John Jenrette, who went out in the abscam convictions, were among the many names that crop up in connection with various attempts to win the release of the Iranian hostages. And of course that...
All right, and that was that One Step Beyond, and talking about J. Stanley Pottinger, and well, more to our purpose in particular here, Cyrus Hashemi, a man who met a mysterious end.
Yeah, in that particular article, and again, if people would like to look it up, June 3rd, 1984, New York Times article by Selwyn Rabb. We only, since in this show we were focusing on Pottinger, the Hashemis are Cyrus Hashemi and his brother. And this is intriguing, and again, we are asking in what capacity he may have been negotiating for the release of the hostages, whether Hashemi may have been part of this back-channel intelligence operation. We can't say, but the association with J. Stanley Pottinger here is interesting, because we talked about Pottinger in our last broadcast.
We're going to talk a little bit more about J. Stanley Pottinger and the rather interesting and fairly influential position that he found himself in, or that we as readers and researchers find him in during the time of the investigation into the death of Orlando Letelier, who, of course, is the Chilean politician, former right-hand man to Salvador Allende, who was blown up on the streets of Washington, D.C., and whose murder and the investigation into whose murder later led back, among other things, into the depths of not only the Chilean secret police, but in fact the CIA itself.
We talked about connecting links between the Letelier assassination, some of the Cubans dating all the way back to J.M. Wave, who later cropped up in the Letelier assassination, the Bosch organization, the Kourou wave of terror, and who later cropped up in the Iran-Contra affair. Names like Frank Castro should be borne in mind, Paco Chanez, and others. Again, details in our last program on the subject.
That's right. Also, a couple of other major names. Ed Wilson himself, who, of course, crops up in Donald Freed's book, Death in Washington, written with Fred Landis, and the David Atlee Phillips, who we mentioned earlier, as being head of the AFIO, the Association of Former Intelligence Officers, of which Miles Copeland was a major figure, and which appears to have been involved in the back channel, and Atlee Phillips was in from the beginning on the destabilization of Chile and Allende, causing Letelier to, of course, have to leave Chile under pain of his life. Anyway, we're going to read now from a brief segment of a book that we have used before on One Step Beyond, but it's going to be useful here. It's from a book called Labyrinth, and it's copyright 1982, written by Eugene M. Proper and Taylor Branch, published in 1982 by the Viking Press. Eugene Proper was one of the investigators, one of the lawyers investigating the Orlando Letelier assassination. And they're talking about his attempts to get in touch with some people at the CIA and find out in his role as a U.S. assistant attorney some of the involvement of any relations or any knowledge that the CIA had about the people involved in the Letelier assassination. Because from very early on, after the initial rather feeble cover story that it was the left trying to create a martyr that had bumped Letelier off, A bunch of the, as Dave mentioned, the Karoo people, the Cuban, the Bay of Pigs folks trained by the Cubans, the Chilean secret police, very closely tied to our own CIA, and others began to crop up. Now, reading from Labyrinth. The next day, he, meaning Proper, received a call from Stanley Pottinger, Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. I should mention at this point that this is during the Ford presidency, and that George Bush is head of the CIA at this time.
Mm-hmm. And it should also be mentioned that Bush was head of the CIA during part of the Task Force 157 Nugenhan Bank operation.
That's right. Pottinger received, Proper received a call from Stanley Pottinger, Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. Pottinger introduced himself over the phone and said he had been speaking with representatives of the Institute for Policy Studies who thought the Civil Rights Division should take over the Letelier case because of its political overtones. The Civil Rights Division offered certain advantages, said Pottinger, through statutes that made murder a federal crime as a violation of civil rights. What did Proper think? Instantly guarded, Proper replied that he already had ample federal jurisdiction through the Protection of Foreign Officials Act, whose murder and conspiracy provisions carry maximum life sentences. In addition, he had two counts of first-degree murder and numerous related charges. The Civil Rights Division could prosecute none of these offenses, nor could its statutes bring to bear such severe penalties. At this, Pottinger retreated a bit, saying he had not realized that Letelier was covered by the foreign officials' law. It would be better for the U.S. Attorney's Office to hit the killers with the full weight of murder charges. Pottinger added that he wanted Proper to know that he and the Civil Rights Division were eager to help in any way they could. Proper thanked him. It was time to be gracious, and Pottinger's offer of assistance clicked with the problem on Proper's mind. He was thinking of the rain and the intimidating CIA building, so he told Pottinger he was afraid he would not get cooperation from the agency. Did Pottinger have any ideas? Instant, warm confidence shot through the telephone line. The Assistant Attorney General replied that he happened to be a personal friend of the CIA director himself, George Bush. Pottinger called him George. For him, the CIA director was only a phone call away. Would Proper like an appointment? By that afternoon, he, Cornick, who's from the FBI, and Pottinger were scheduled for lunch with Director Bush at CIA headquarters on Monday. A Justice Department limousine would pick them up at noon. Proper whistled to himself. This was known in Washington as access.
And again, it should be noted that George Bush is a, although his name has hardly surfaced, just like that of Kissinger. Well, actually, his name has surfaced more than Kissinger's, but not much. George Bush appears to be a prime player in the Iran-Contra scandal. We took a look at Bush's connections, or accounts of Bush's connections to this affair, in our first program, the Drug Connections program, Radio Free America number 29. So again, the exact nature of Cyrus Hashemi's role in these affairs remains sort of clouded, but in light of his attempts to work out negotiations to free the hostages, his connections with J. Stanley Pottinger, and J. Stanley Pottinger's connections to the Letelier assassination team, many elements of which were in the Contra supply operation, certainly there are a lot of very important questions to be asked about just what Cyrus Hashemi's intentions were, who he was actually working for, although, again, this is an area which is largely a question mark in the unfolding of this whole scandal. There are indications that not only did the Reagan, well, actually it was not the Reagan administration at the time, but the Reagan campaign, not only did they help to get rid of the, to subvert the attempted hostage rescue mission, but indeed, there are a lot of indications that a deal was worked out with the Iranians to withhold the hostage release until after Ronald Reagan was elected, thereby assuring Jimmy Carter's defeat. In return, the Iranians were promised arms for their war with Iraq. There are a lot of indications of such a deal. We're going to go into those right now. One of the accounts of this deal comes from the San Jose Mercury News of Sunday morning, April 12th of 1987. This is a story by Alfonso Chardy, C-H-A-R-D-Y, who writes for the Mercury News Washington Bureau, also for the Miami Herald. This story is Dateline Washington, headlined, Iranian Offer to Candidate Reagan, subheaded, Purported Envoy Suggested Deal to Free U.S. Hostages in Tehran, Aides Say. 1 month before Ronald Reagan defeated Jimmy Carter in the 1980 presidential election, two Reagan campaign aides met secretly with a man who said he represented the Iranian government and who offered to release to candidate Reagan 52 American hostages being held in Tehran, according to the aides. Richard Allen and Lawrence Silberman, who were top foreign policy advisors to Reagan's campaign, said the offer by the purported Iran envoy, who was brought to the meeting by then-Senate aide and Reagan supporter Robert C. McFarlane, was intended to ensure President Carter's defeat in the November election. Sticking in parenthetically, remember Robert C. McFarlane. We're going to talk about him and some of the people he's connected to in a second. Allen and Silberman said in separate telephone interviews last week that they considered the offer absurd and rejected it, telling the man that he had to deal with Carter. Both said they cannot recall the man's name or nationality. Although nothing apparently came of the October meeting, I would interject that's Chardy's opinion, the former president of Iran said in an interview last week that two of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini's closest advisors arranged with the Reagan campaign to delay release of the hostages until after Reagan was sworn in as president. Abolhassan Banisadr, now in exile in France, said in a telephone interview that he learned in 1981 that the advisors, then Interior Minister Ali Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani and Mohammad Beheshti, a member of the Revolutionary Council, coordinated the release to coincide with Reagan's inauguration on January 20, 1981. Banisadr also said that after the hostages were freed, he received a military report that the Reagan administration had given assurances to Tehran that it would receive U.S. military equipment for use in its war with Iraq. Banisadr said the assurances were not linked to the release of the hostages, and he said he did not know whether the arms were received. I would interject again, we now know that the arms were received. Skipping down. He here refers to Richard Allen. Nevertheless, he and Silberman, skipping down in the article, nevertheless, Allen and Silberman, now a Reagan-appointed judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, said that at McFarlane's behest, they met in early October 1980 for about 20 to 30 minutes at the L'Enfant Plaza Hotel with a man who allegedly represented the Khomeini regime. Allen was the head of Reagan's Foreign Policy Advisory Group, and Silberman was its co-chairman. They said McFarlane, then a staff member on the Senate Armed Services Committee, also attended the meeting. McFarlane declined to be interviewed about how he met the emissary or why he brought him to Allen and Silberman. In a written response to questions, McFarlane said, quote, "An individual claiming to be Iranian approached me and was referred to the Reagan campaign staff. He was judged to be a fraud and dismissed," unquote. Both Allen and Silberman said they could not recall the identity or nationality of the alleged Khomeini representative. In his written response, McFarlane said that he had, quote, "no idea who the man was other than his claim to be Iranian." All I can remember was that there was discussion about somehow releasing the hostages to the Reagan campaign or under the auspices of the Reagan campaign to humiliate Carter and influence our election, Silberman said. A couple of points to be borne in mind. This mystery man who approached them, his identity is yet to be determined. One thing that I think researchers should ask and attempt to answer is whether that mystery man may have been the late Cyrus Hashemi. Only a possibility, but one wonders. And certainly a lot more needs to be learned. Another interesting detail, where we'll flesh this out later in the program, was that Robert McFarlane, the person who helped make this contact with this mysterious Iranian, was serving as a staff member on the Senate Armed Services Committee. That in and of itself doesn't say much, but the person on whose staff he was serving was John Tower, the person who headed up the Tower Commission, and that commission, of course, was named after him. Robert McFarland is an interesting individual and has connections with a lot of other people as well.
Before getting into McFarland any further, and without wanting to open a whole can of worms, to use an old cliche, one of the other things that's interesting, too, about this Allen story, about this mysterious Iranian, or alleged Iranian who showed up, is why would Allen admit to that in the first place? That's, again, something to put in the thought bank for a while, is why would Allen float that story anyway? I mean, what possible purpose would it serve? What if it in fact didn't happen or was unimportant? Why would he even mention it? If it was important, what are we not getting there, and what are we being given instead? So something to think about. It's kind of a strange little story for a guy to come out and admit to. Yeah.
We're going to take a look at some information from another former Reagan campaign aide, Barbara Honegger, which directly contradicts what Allen said.
All right, back to Robert McFarlane. We're going to read a short segment of a shortish article that was contributed to us by Mabe Russell.
And again, bear in mind that McFarlane is the person who handled most of the contacts, the actual physical contacts with this mysterious Iranian.
That's right. This article is from the Wall Street Journal for December 5th, 1985, and the article is headlined, McFarlane Quits, Admiral is Named to Succeed Him. The article is by Jane Mayer and Robert S. Greenberger of the Wall Street Journal staff, Dateline Washington. National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane resigned, and President Reagan named Vice Admiral John Poindexter to succeed him. Admiral Poindexter, who has been Mr. McFarlane's deputy, is likely to be a more military-oriented but far less politically experienced advisor on foreign affairs than his former chief. Skipping on down a section of the article where they talk about they blame this on strife between McFarlane and Reagan. And interestingly enough, one White House staffer characterizes Poindexter as, quote, almost apolitical, unquote. Skipping down, confidence of Mr. McFarlane have suggested in recent days that frayed relations with White House Chief of Staff Donald Reagan, whom Mr. McFarlane reportedly saw as too meddlesome in foreign affairs, were among the reasons he decided to resign. But at a news conference yesterday, Mr. McFarlane called such accounts nonsense. He gave no explanation for his departure, however. When asked what his plans are, he answered, quote, I have no plans, and I don't know. If you have any leads, let me know. Associates of Mr. McFarlane have said he hopes to find work in the private sector, possibly with his former mentor, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who was an international consultant in New York. So again, dating way back to Task Force 157 and the involvement of Task Force 157 and, among other things, setting up the Vang Pao opium money and putting it in Nugenhan Bank and using it to fund various operations, including one of the operations that was then transferred to Tehran, Iran, by Shackley, Kleins et al., and we find Kissinger's name cropping up again as the mentor of Robert McFarlane, the man who, as Dave mentioned, was the primary contact point between this mysterious Iranian and the folks in the White House.
And again, the Henry Kissinger links to the secret team through Task Force 157 should be borne in mind, as should Kissinger's role in getting the hostages taken in the first place by prevailing on Jimmy Carter to admit the Shah when the entire State Department and CIA knew what would happen as a result. Indications that, in fact, just such an October surprise deal was worked out between Richard Allen and other members of the Reagan campaign has come from a number of different sources. One of the better articles is an article by Christopher Hitchens in The Nation, specifically in The Nation's issue of July 4th through 11th of 1987. And Kissinger meddling in American foreign policy when he has no business doing so is not an unprecedented event, and the beginning of Christopher Hitchens' article here discussing the deal between the alleged deal, and it appears to be pretty solid, between the Reagan campaign and the Iranians begins with an account of Henry Kissinger's sabotaging of the Vietnam peace talks in 1968. This is from Minority Report, The Nation, July 4th through 11th, 1987, Christopher Hitchens. In the fall of 1968, the incumbent Democrats were making steady progress in the opinion polls. Despite their appalling record on Vietnam, they had a chance to win re-election by organizing a peace conference to end the war. The Nixon campaign had as its foreign policy coordinator a man named Richard V. Allen. Allen made it his task to develop contact with moles in the government machine because, as Seymour Hersh wrote in The Price of Power, Nixon knew the Johnson administration was involved in a desperate attempt to get some kind of substantive peace talks underway in Paris and thus improve Humphrey's chances in the election, unquote. With the help of these insiders, who included Henry Kissinger, and with the assistance of right-wing fanatics like Anna Chennault, a back channel, unquote, to the South Vietnamese was established. It was made plain to the South Vietnamese that they would get a better deal from the Nixon administration. On November 2, 1968, 2 days after the White House announced that he would be participating in the Paris peace talks, and 3 days before the U.S. elections, President Nguyen Van Thieu of Vietnam withdrew from the negotiations. His timing was disastrous for the talks and for the Democratic ticket. In Minority Report for June 20th, I suggested that the Reagan campaign in 1980 might have played a similar game with the mullahs in Tehran. Did it assure them that if they kept the American hostages until after the elections, the Reagan administration would reward Iran with weapons? This would explain the timing of the hostage release and the almost immediate shipment of arms via Israel to Iran when no hostages were being held and no moderates, unquote, were on the horizon. Further evidence for this hypothesis follows. In the first 2 weeks of October 1980, three prominent Reaganites met with an envoy of the Iranian regime. The meeting took place in the L'Enfant Plaza Hotel in Washington. It was arranged by Robert McFarlane, then working for Senator John Tower, and attended by Lawrence Silberman, co-chair of the Reagan-Bush Foreign Policy Advisory Group. Also present was the other co-chair, Richard V. Allen. Allen, who became Reagan's first national security advisor, now claims that his notes of the meeting have been mislaid, unquote. But Abolhassan Bani Sadra, who was president of Iran at the time, says that two Ayatollahs did negotiate through intermediaries with the Reagan campaign, trading the humiliation of Carter for future arms deliveries. According to the excellent Alfonso Chardy of the Miami Herald, Bani Sadra identifies the two as Hashemi Rafsanjani and Mohammad Beheshti. Rafsanjani has since emerged as the Iranian of choice in all the Reagan administration's arms deals. Barbara Honegger, H-O-N-E-G-G-E-R, who served as a researcher in the Reagan campaign and later as a policy analyst at the White House, says she was in the Reagan headquarters in Arlington, Virginia on October 24th or 25th, 1980 at about 11 p.m., when an excited staffer in the operations center, unquote, said, quote, "We don't have to worry about an October surprise. Dick cut a deal." Dick was Richard Allen.
Continuing. A memorandum in Allen's handwriting, printed in the White House, in the House Investigating Committee's report on the theft of President Carter's campaign papers, is dated October 10th, 1980. One entry reads, quote, "FCI, partial release of hostages for parts," unquote. FCI are the initials of Fred C. Eclay, now an Undersecretary of Defense and then a member of one of Reagan's action groups on the October surprise. According to the House investigation, there were two teams that sought to deny President Carter an October surprise success in releasing the hostages. The first met in the Skyline House in Falls Church, Virginia, and consisted of Edwin Meese III, William Casey, Richard Werthlin, Pete Daly, and Admiral Robert Garrick. This was the group described by Casey as, quote, "an intelligence operation." The second team was convened by Allen and included Fred Eclay, John Lehman, and Admiral Thomas Moore. Speaking before the House committee, which alas did not hold public hearings and did not compel testimony under oath, Meese, Casey, and James Baker III all confirmed that Admiral Garrick ran a network of serving and retired officers whose job was to watch U.S. bases for any signs of unusual activity that might suggest a rescue operation. Garrick confirmed this in his own testimony, but claimed that he could not remember the names of his informants or the names of the bases. The committee found that, quote, "Garrick's lack of memory about his alleged network is not credible," unquote. Again, according to the House investigation, secret documents from the U.S. Embassy in Tehran were found in the file of Edwin Meese and Anthony Dolan, now Reagan's chief speechwriter. The committee determined that, quote, "these copies were obtained from Iran after being in the possession of Iranians." One of these documents, unearthed from Meese's file, has an attached handwritten note of acknowledgement from Reagan, signed Ron. By way of the FBI, Reagan told the committee that, quote, "he was not certain who provided him with the documents." A Reaganite staffer on the Senate Intelligence Committee, Angelo Codavia, informed the House committee that he had been told of active-duty CIA agents who worked for the Bush campaign. Richard Allen's telephone log for October 13, 1980, reads, III-5, Angelo Codavia, 938-9702, DIA, hostages all back in compound last week, administration embargoed intelligence, confirmed, and confirmed is in italics. As the committee's report dryly notes, quote, "neither Allen nor Codavia could provide information concerning the meaning of this note," unquote. Well, the hostages were released at just the right time, and the first shipments of weapons began the very next month. You may wonder if the Reaganites were capable of making such a vile deal. But you don't really wonder that, do you? Let me give the last word to former President Bani Sadr. Quote, "I don't know precisely why the timing of the release was so important to the Reagan apparatus, but it seems to me that his aides were trying to prepare the American public psychologically and symbolically for the era of Reaganism, unquote. It is more than time that these questions got the special prosecutor they deserve. Okay, so we've seen a bunch of interesting things here. Again, as mentioned, the similarity to the 1968 back-channel intelligence network that Deep Six, the Paris Peace Talks.
Also involving Henry Kissinger.
Also involving Henry Kissinger. And the even more concrete and hard to misconstrue information about the action teams put together to monitor the Carter White House. And again, this particular notation from Angelo Codevilla with a phone number then says DIA, which probably stands for Defense Intelligence Agency, saying hostages all back in compound last week, administration embargoed intelligence confirmed. It's very obvious that the Reagan team and the secret team had more than just a few elderly Marine and Naval officers kind of watching the ports. It's obvious that they had first-level information and that they had information that no innocent political purpose could possibly have been helped by. I mean, there's no... somebody asked in one of the other articles, what could they possibly have done with this information besides used it to sabotage the mission? There's nothing else they could have done. They could have, had a parade, perhaps, on the day that the hostages were released to try and distract attention? Of course not. There was nothing they could do with this information except try to sabotage the rescue operation in some way and hence sabotage the Carter presidency.